It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with a friend if you find it of interest. Today, I have as my guest Rebecca Heinrichs. She is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, an expert when it comes to nuclear policy, and is someone who is very focused on the current war in Ukraine and Russia's potential nuclear action in response to it. This is something that's obviously shown up in the news headlines over the past several weeks as something of increasing likelihood and concern among policymakers. Rebecca talks to us about the possibility of Russia using nuclear weapons, what America's response would potentially be, and the way the Biden administration has generally approached brinkmanship in this context. Rebecca Heinrichs coming up next.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Rebecca Heinrichs, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks. Happy to be here, Ben.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what's going on in terms of the Russian posture toward Ukraine and toward the West. But before I get started, I wondered if you could give our listeners a little bit of your own background in terms of the work that you do at Hudson.
Sure. Well, I'm a senior fellow here at Hudson Institute, so I write, talk a lot about international relations generally, but my focus is on really how to deter major wars. And so the kinds of things that I think about a lot are major weapons programs, big missile systems, our nuclear weapons, which are our backbone of our national defense. So I think about how do we kind of think about nuclear weapons? How do we signal to deter major kinds of war? And then I think about, you know, are there other things that we can be doing to make sure that we can establish and protect U.S. interests the world over, constantly contemplating, thinking about what those interests are. So that's what I spend a lot of time doing at Hudson. I have a recent report that just came out last Friday that talks about the kinds of things that we might need to do as a country in order to improve the tools that we have for greater deterrence in light of Russia's war against Ukraine and how they are using nuclear weapons, wielding them in order to carry out their war against Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So I talk about all kinds of things in international relations, but mainly my focus is on how do we successfully implement and carry out deterrence now that we're so many decades out away from the Cold War, something we thought about deterrence a lot during the Cold War and then haven't put as much serious thought into how that might look now.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the state of the U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals. What do those kind of look like in terms of the amount of missiles, the amount of warheads, the kind of level of nuclear array that could be thrown out there?
So it's a great question. And this is something, a couple big points on this. One, a lot of times when people think about nuclear weapons, just your average person trying to think, oh, my goodness, like nuclear war, what do we need in order to make sure that doesn't happen? People kind of intuitively think it's just about a number of equal numbers, that if they have this many, we have this many, then generally kind of this idea of mutually assured destruction. If they hit us, we will respond and hit them. And then that's basically, you know, what you need in order to have stability. And so we have it. The New START treaty with the Russians caps the number of delivery systems that we can deploy that has nuclear weapons on them. It's 1550 for the United States and the Russian Federation. What is not captured in any arms control treaty with the Russians are these theater range nuclear weapons. The Russians have insisted on not even talking about them in any kinds of arms control discussion. And really, since the 90s, the United States under George H.W. Bush began very, very aggressively divesting of these kinds of nuclear weapons. So when I talk about theater range, you know, it's various yields, but it's the kinds of weapons that you might actually employ regionally in theater, not the kinds of weapons that you would launch from your own territory that that are highly destructive, not intercontinental ballistic missiles. We're talking about smaller range, theater range nuclear weapons. The Russians, public documents show that the Russians outnumber U.S., NATO theater range nuclear weapons 10 to 1. And that is really where there is some asymmetry. And I'll leave it at that in terms of capability. But then we can sort of get into why we're talking about nuclear weapons so much in with Russia's war against Ukraine. And their capabilities obviously have something to do with that. But how they think about nuclear weapons is also very, very different than how the United States thinks about nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I'd like you to get into that, because I think people basically understand the way that the United States thinks about it. But maybe start with that first and then give us a comparison with how the Russians think about them.
Sure. So we the United States has very intentionally in all of our public documents, declaratory policy, we do not rule out scenarios in which, you know, the United States, let me put it this way, we have not adopted an explicit no first use policy, meaning we keep it ambiguous about when we might employ a nuclear weapon, but it is generally understood that the United States would only use a nuclear weapon in the most dire situations in which we are trying to deter a major war. We do not say that it would have to be a nuclear employment. You can use conventional weapons in a massive way to harm the United States of America. And so we don't want to unintentionally convey a point to our adversaries that as long as they don't use a nuclear weapon, they're safe from U.S. retaliatory Gotcha. Options for nuclear weapons. So, but generally speaking, they are defensive. We use them to deter, and then we have a spectrum of nuclear capabilities in the event that deterrence fails, so that we can quickly try to put a lid on what the adversary is doing to keep the level of violence on the lowest levels possible. So they are defensive, they're for deterrence. And then if deterrence fails, we want to end the war as quickly as possible without ceding U.S. territory and territory of our allies. The Russians, on the other hand, the way to think about it is, so when we think about nuclear weapons, we think that the threshold's very high for when we would have to employ one. The Russians have lowered the nuclear threshold. So they're much less squeamish than the West is and the United States is about using nuclear weapons. There's this doctrine that's unofficial in Russia that is escalate to de-escalate. So in a purely conventional conflict, purely conventional non-nuclear conflict like what we're seeing in Ukraine, the Russians might employ a nuclear weapon in theater in order to cause the United States, the Biden administration, NATO to say, oh, my goodness, this is not worth it. And to basically just fold, to pull back. In the case of Ukraine, say, you can have it. You can have whatever you want, but we're not going to respond in any way. We're not going to further escalate. So it's this escalate to de-escalate. And that's what we are very concerned about the Russians might do. And because basically any kind of weapon system that they build in theater, they've made it so that it's nuclear capable. The joke, it's not really a funny joke. The joke is like, if it has wheels, there's a nuke on it. If it can fly, there's a nuke on it. And so it makes it very difficult for the United States government to then, this is in public reporting. I think it was in Politico, where basically we won't know. We won't have a big heads up when the Russians are about to employ a nuclear weapon in Ukraine, because so much of what they have is either conventional or can have a nuclear capability as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think has certainly been said by opponents of the U.S.'s funding of Ukraine to the degree that it has been sending them billions of dollars has been this idea that American involvement would lead to an increased likelihood of the Russians using a nuclear weapon. I've never really understood that argument. Could you tell me why people sort of advance it and what you think of that argument?
Well, I mean, it kind of gets to the heart of, I mean, I think one of the big reasons or the most fundamental problems that we're seeing with U.S. commentary and why people are disagreeing about what's going on is that there is just a misunderstanding or there's a failure of a common understanding about what Russia's ultimate aims are, what their goals are. And so we know that Ukraine doesn't have nuclear weapons. Really, whenever you think about, I was recently in Poland and we were talking with allies and somebody made the point, and I thought it was so profound that when we talk about Article 5 of the NATO treaty, we talk about the NATO alliance, we talk about the U.S. leadership in Europe, what we're really talking about is, yes, the U.S. military backing and supporting the security of our allies, but with all the way to the full force of American nuclear weapons. That's the backstop of American power, American strength. And so the concern that some people have is that, well, if the United States is going to support Ukraine, and if the United States is fully committed to making good on our Article 5 commitments, that what we're talking about here is anything that Russia does to harm an ally or a NATO ally, that this could escalate to the point where nuclear employment can happen. But this idea that the United States would preemptively be the first one to use a nuclear weapon in Europe, there's no basis for that. There's no reason for that. There's no historical reason in this scenario that matches up to anything else that would make that reasonable. So the United States is still, again, and I have argued, I've written about this a lot, you know, the Biden administration has been so afraid of this war escalating to higher levels of escalation where the Russians might use a nuclear weapon, this idea that it's the United States that could be the one to threaten nuclear use first, there's no basis in that kind of argument or belief.
The argument that has been playing out in the last couple of days surrounding the reporting about what the Biden administration has expressed to the Russians is something that I wanted to get into with you. According to the Financial Times, we have no reason, I think, to doubt this, just given some of the public messaging around it. The Russians have been told by the Biden administration that their use of a nuclear weapon would not guarantee a response in kind, but rather it would essentially guarantee that the U.S. would join the war effort in Ukraine in a conventional way on the side of Zelensky and his government. What do you think about that message? What does it actually send? And is it really the wise course to send that kind of message to the Russians about the breaking the seal on nuclear weapons?
So I want to bring up that the breaking the seal on nuclear weapons is critically important as we think about this very, very carefully. No nuclear weapon has been used in warfare since the United States ended World War II in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That is the last time a nuclear weapon has been used. It was used to end that war. And no nuclear weapon has been used in warfare since. It is to the American people's great advantage and security for that to remain the case, for us to continue to live in the nuclear peace. It is not guaranteed. We as a country have had strategists working very hard on this issue since the Cold War to figure out how do we, the United States, how do we conduct our foreign affairs in the world on terms most favorable to protect and prosper the American people without a major war, and conventional major wars can escalate to nuclear war. So we want to prevent those too. Okay, so that is where, so, you know, whenever I hear some people sort of flippantly say, if a nuclear weapon is used, we should just pull back, and then what's it to us? It is to our great benefit that no nuclear weapon is used in warfare. So it is paramount that the United States government work very, very hard to convince the Russians that a nuclear employment anywhere in Ukraine, certainly in NATO territory, but in Ukraine, would result in a U.S. response that would cause the Russians to regret that they had done that. So that's kind of where you begin, because deterrence is all about convincing the foe so that they calculate it's not going to be worth it. Whatever that is, it's not going to be worth it. So I don't think they need to put a fine point on what will happen. I think that they should 100% not be taking things off the table. They should 100% not be saying that the United States will not respond with a nuclear weapon. I think that that should absolutely be part of the toolkit that we have, and that we convince the Russians that not only do we have the ability to do that, we don't have as many as they have. The Trump administration worked to get more theater nuclear weapons back out to sea. And we need to work at getting more of those, again, in order to convince the adversary that they will not have any military benefit in doing that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was a very big mistake. I think that some of the public rhetoric from Jake Sullivan has been good. He has said that it would be catastrophic results. I think that the Russians would, but whatever they're saying behind the scenes to the Russians, they should not be doing anything that gives Vladimir Putin any ease as he goes to bed at night. Mm-hmm. He should be constantly concluding that he should not resort to nuclear weapon in Ukraine because of what that might mean for a U.S. and NATO response.
You know, I'm curious what changed in terms of the Democratic foreign policy elite, and I say that within quotation marks, from the 1990s to today, because I remember Bill Clinton going to the DMZ and being asked, you know, what would happen if you know, North Korea was to come into South Korea, and his response was and to use potentially nuclear or other weapons to do it, and his response was, you know, that their country as they know it would cease to exist. Which to me is the kind of thing that, you know, sends the right kind of message in terms of any kind of showdown, that you don't want the other side to think that they have any way of getting away with this type of deployment. Why does the foreign policy establishment of the moment, of the Biden administration, think that a softer approach would do anything but invite the use of a nuclear weapon?
I mean, there's a couple of things in deterrence thought. There's strands of thought that have always existed in commentary since the Cold War that seems to have taken hold with President Biden himself early on and never really left. And so I've said before that watching him as president is so chilling and odd and interesting, because it says that every decision, everything that he concluded 30 years ago, 40 years ago, he still thinks. And so things have changed. He's now in a position of power where he's going to have to adapt. And yet he has he's very ideological and rigid in his thinking. Mm-hmm. And my view has been, he has taken hold of this idea that if the United States does not respond, just even take nuclear weapons off the table for a second and just think about everything that we've done in this war so far. Every time the Russians do something, act aggressively, you know, the Biden administration very, very early on kept saying, we won't do this in response. We will not provide real-time intelligence. We will not provide HIMARS. We will not permit the Poles to send in the MiGs. We will not do these things. And this idea was, well, look how good we're being. The Russians should no longer escalate because we're not doing all these other things that we could do, and we're not. And of course, the Russians have responded by doing all of those, you know, increasing escalation vertically. And then now, if they're the ones that have destroyed the Nord Stream 2 pipelines, they're escalating horizontally. They're spreading the geographic area in which they're launching attacks that are problematic for Europe and the West. So they continue to escalate when they see the United States won't stand firm. And of course, it doesn't work. You know, appeasement, capitulation, not responding simply invites further aggression. And we're watching that play out in real time. I mean, it's a little bit counterintuitive, and there is risk in it. I'm not saying that any of this is sort of, you know, just a very easy or simple or sure. But generally, you want to demonstrate to the adversary that he will regret it, so that you can try to establish escalation dominance, escalation management, control. Otherwise, he's just controlling it. And that's what we've seen. And just to foot stomp another point I made, that's how you get to the point of the nuclear precipice. It doesn't come out of the blue. It's that it's a conventional war. And inside the war, we still should be trying to compel the Russians to back down. The Biden administration just seems to believe if we just keep arming Ukraine, basically about how Russia is doing, that this will keep the war contained. It is not keeping the war contained. It is causing the war to get worse. And so it, again, maybe a little bit counterintuitive for the folks inside the White House, certainly for President Biden, who seems to just hold on to this strain of thought, but it's not. It's actually strength and actually going bigger to convince the Russians that we have had enough and they should stop. We're getting far too close to that nuclear precipice, and they will regret it if they cross that line.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the nature of grain in Ukraine as being a potential side effect of why the Russians would, you know, perhaps not want to use a nuke. You know, I've read in multiple places that, you know, the value of that grain would be destroyed potentially in any kind of nuclear exchange, and that that would have obviously wide ranging effects for the world's economy, and but also be something that would hurt the Russians themselves. How much of that is a concern that potentially factors into their thinking?
Well, we hope that they're thinking all of this through. Of course, if they're the ones, which I'm now persuaded, nobody knows at this point, but I'm persuaded now that it was the Russians that blew up those pipelines, and they didn't care about any of the environmental catastrophe around that area either. And so, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, really, nothing that the Russians have done so far against Ukraine seems to be what makes the most sense for the Russian Federation. So you're kind of starting from a little bit trying to get inside the head of Vladimir Putin and to understand the value of what he thinks he's doing and what the risks and rewards are for different things. And so I certainly hope that he would take that into account. But he has been very willing to do things that, by all accounts, I mean, has made him an international pariah. I mean, his whole country was so much better off pre-invasion of Ukraine that sometimes you wonder, you know, what exactly is the end state and what kind of risk is he willing to take on? And what does he think he's going to do if he destroys? I mean, Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe. That's what it's known for because of its fertile soil, because of the wheat, because of everything that it provides and feeds to African countries, but also to Europe. It affects it affects American farmers. I keep talking about Americans say, what do we care again about this? I mean, these are items that affect the entire global economy. And farmers rely on fertilizer that is affected by the war in Ukraine. And so the costs of farming and food in the United States, we're going to see it go up as the next crops come in the next year or two. So, I mean, I hope that the Russians think that would be bad for us in a way that isn't worth the cost. But I'm not convinced that that is enough to persuade them. I think at this point, we need to figure out, and those inside who have greater, you know, access to information than I do inside the U.S. government need to be figuring out what is it that Putin does not want to happen, that would be a bridge too far for him. That is exactly what we should be threatening to do in order to actually convince him to stop this unjust war.
Would Putin use a nuclear weapon in Europe if it was not, let's say, to necessarily gain Ukraine, in other words, to win the war, but to save his regime by basically turning this into a true conflict with NATO?
It's a really good question. And again, it's going to get into the psychology of Putin and what it is that he wants. I'm still of the belief, very welcome, you know, I'm very, very open to admitting that none of us really know for sure what's going on. Mm-hmm. But that Putin still very much does not want this to turn into a direct military conflict with the United States and NATO. And so what he seems to be doing is trying to pull at the seams and push on the vulnerabilities and weaknesses within the NATO alliance. And what he seems to know very well about President Biden's fear of nuclear employment. And so he's wielding this nuclear, you know, he's sword over this whole conflict to intimidate President Biden so that President Biden only authorizes various things to Ukraine on the lower levels of escalation to keep this. That seems to be what he's doing, which tells me he really, really, really does not want to go head to head with the United States. When you think about it, Ukraine is doing so, so well, given the fact that I mean, it's just this nation since 2014, they couldn't do this whenever they were first invaded, and how valiantly they've been fighting. But it's American weaponry. It's American training. It's American help in a variety of ways. Now, imagine if it wasn't Ukraine doing this with American help, but if it was actually the United States of America. So I think that the Russians should know that by now. So it seems like they're trying to get what they want militarily and politically while avoiding that. And so it's up to then the United States of America to say, no, you're going to close these holes that the Russians keep poking through. But it's going to take changing President Biden's mind about deterrence and about escalation from as far as I can tell that he's held these views for decades and has been unwilling to change his mind, despite the overwhelming evidence that they're not working and that he's wrong.
What would Russia nuke? And what would we potentially nuke in response?
Great question. I like to normally when somebody asks me that, I say, and then that's whenever I turn it over to the operational folks and the folks that have to do the targeting. I can give a sort of a menu of things that we can think about. I mean, the Russians, you know, nuclear weapons, you can detonate them in different ways to create different levels of destruction. The Russians might do just sort of a demonstration detonation where they use a nuclear weapon in an area where there isn't a whole lot of military activity, and they do that to scare, again, to frighten the United States and NATO. So sort of a demonstration. Or they could use a nuclear weapon against a military target in Ukraine. Of course, depending on how close they get to civilians, that will affect the civilian death, casualties, fallout, depending on how they employ it. And so all of that will impact what would be an appropriate response for the United States of America. So it's really hard to know until you kind of see this play out. How the United States thinks about it is we try to think about what would be a proportional response, and not just for proportionality, like legally sort of like tit for tat, but that would defend the innocent and would cause the adversary to stop without doing damage to innocent civilians. That's how the United States thinks about all warfare, but it's really how we think about deterrence. So then we would think about what are the targets if we were to go the nuclear route that would cause minimal civilian casualties, but would stop the adversary's ability to continue to retaliate in the most likely way that they would retaliate. So I don't know. We could take out a ship. We could take out a Russian ship. Depends on what the Russians use. I mean, I would advise against doing anything in Ukraine. Ukrainians have suffered enough. And so any kind of U.S. retaliation is going to have to be against a Russian target, military target outside of Ukraine.
Would Putin potentially do something as rash as use a nuclear weapon against Kyiv?
I think that I don't know what's in his head. I think that he has done a lot of things that don't make political and military sense in some regards. And so I wouldn't put it out of the question. There's lots of things that Putin can do to harm Kyiv and to harm civilians that he hasn't chosen to do yet. So he wouldn't have to go all the way to a nuclear employment to do that. Obviously, we haven't seen chemical and biological weapons use yet. We haven't seen him going through and just doing more conventional kind of attacks directly targeting civilians lately, again, in the capital city. And so there's other things that he could do too. So would he do that? I mean, to me, that seems very, very unlikely. There's other things that he could do, I think, that would get the response that he wants before he would go all the way that route. I think if he went that route, it is my belief that the United States, along with a coalition of ally partners, if not all of NATO, would certainly act in a way to end this war finally, in a way in which Putin would no longer be able to not only carry out this war in Ukraine, but I think continue his imperialist ambitions elsewhere and beyond. I mean, that would be such a violation of the laws of war and of everything I think that NATO could stomach. I mean, even the extremely reluctant Germans, I think, would have to say, this is enough. They've gone too far.
Russia and China have obviously grown closer together during this time. Do the Chinese oppose the use of this type of weapon? Do they have a factor, basically, a vote in this?
Yeah, so that's the very honest answer is I really don't know. The thing about the Chinese that it's even more difficult to understand than the Russians is they're so opaque. They really do not talk about a lot of this stuff in their material. And so the folks that I would rely on to say, what do they think about this? Or how do they think about doctrine? That isn't, especially during the war in Ukraine, I keep kind of pressing on this, and we just don't know. It's not a lot out there. We do know that the Russians and the Chinese, obviously there's a convergence there. The Chinese have given rhetorical support to Russia's war against Ukraine. They've continued military training. We have not seen the Chinese arm the Russians in a way that we thought that they might. The Russians are getting drones from the Iranians, but the Chinese have not done that up until this point. The one thing that the Chinese are watching everything the Russians do, and they're learning. They're learning what different things will cause and elicit different reactions from the West. I would hope the Chinese would understand that would be, it would elicit a response that would be awful, catastrophic against the Russians, because we must maintain this nuclear peace. And so, would there be some kind of interest on the Chinese part to see? Because the Chinese I've talked about how the Russians have invested so much in these theater range nuclear weapons. The Chinese have done that too. The Chinese have invested in, they're in this, what the commander of U.S. Strategic Command, Admiral Richard, has called a strategic breakout. So they're investing in a robust nuclear weapons architecture systems, a variety of weapons, and many delivery systems that can be used in theater as well. And so in any kind of active aggression against Taiwan, the Chinese are obviously looking to see what's going on with the Russians in Ukraine. I'm very worried that because the Russians have so successfully caused the Biden administration to be deterred and to only supply Ukraine with certain kinds of weapons on these lower levels of escalation, I'm concerned that message has been sent to China that brandishing your nuclear weapons works against the United States. Mm-hmm. That any time you want to redraw borders and invade a democratic country, that if you do nuclear saber rattling, that you will frighten us from intervening on levels necessary to actually help that democratic country push back and win and prevail and defend their own sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult question. Would they want them to? I can't imagine that they would, but they would certainly glean very, very important information from how that would play out if it did happen.
Last question, Rebecca. Do you believe that our current political leadership, and that, includes Democrats and Republicans, in Washington is mindful of how real the threat of nuclear usage is here? Or do you believe that they are perhaps inaccurately underrating the likelihood that a nuclear weapon could be used?
I think that, I would actually put my concern at, I don't think that the level of education and understanding about what is necessary to deter the use of a nuclear weapon is up to speed. So I mm-hmm. think that there might be some fear, and maybe to the point of irrational fear on the part of President Biden about nuclear use. That's why he keeps saying, I don't want World War III. I don't want World War III. So this is why we're not. This is why he wrote that New York Times piece saying what we wouldn't do to help Ukraine. So it's essentially frozen, paralyzed him to the point where he's permitting Ukraine to not lose immediately, but he's not permitting Ukraine to win because of this fear. And that kind of misunderstanding, that wrong view of how deterrence actually works and escalation control and what we would need if we tried to have escalation control, that education is, I think, not up to speed. It's absent in some parts of Congress. It's better in some other Republican. The Armed Services Committee is pretty good on this, very good, I should say, on thinking this through. And there is some bipartisan consensus about the need to have a modern nuclear deterrent in order to deter. But we must get back to really thinking hard and not just kind of having these emotional responses about nuclear weapons. We need to think hard about what is necessary to convince the adversary that we will make sure that they will regret that they have done that. And so if deterrence breaks down, that the United States can prevail on the lowest levels of destruction, in a way that's most beneficial to U.S. interests. That we need a return to thinking very, very seriously about this, like members of Congress did. If you go back and read some of the transcripts from the hearings during the Cold War, it's remarkable to hear, to look, and to read how these members of Congress and senators were struggling and trying to understand this. We need a return to that kind of rigorous analysis and thinking. And above all, and this is something that you can't really teach, you either have it or you don't, you have to really want to defend your own interests and your own people, and you must have the political courage necessary so that the adversary believes that with all these capabilities, we will use them in defense of our people and the American way of life.
Rebecca Heinrichs, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks, Ben.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this. I wanted to share with you some analysis from Joshua Trevino from his Armus newsletter, a Substack, which you can subscribe to at armus.co. That's ARMAS.co. He offers analysis of a lot of different things related to global affairs and to the American domestic situation. But he's particularly insightful when it comes to military matters. He writes in part in his latest edition, "The Russians, notably but not only Putin and Medvedev, have been vocal on their willingness to resort to nuclear weapons in the past several days. This is not new and not in itself evidence that they will. The reason they wouldn't do so before, and I don't just mean in the past few months, but in the past 73 years, is fairly well outlined by Kahn's escalation dominance theory set forth above." You can find the Herman Kahn analysis of escalation domination theory in his newsletter. "Soviet and Russian leadership always understood, as we understood in turn, that to resort to nuclear arms on the European continent would be to guarantee a retaliation that would achieve all three of the conditions noted above. They wouldn't win, they would lose, and that they had no interest in the option. In short, if they used nuclear weapons, they would endure nuclear attack in turn. Formal Soviet warfighting doctrine, and for all we know, Russian doctrine now, actually accepted this. We know, for example, in the 7 days to the River Rhine scenario for Warsaw Pact aggression to the Franco-German border, that they envisioned an immediate nuclear exchange in Central Europe. We know that NATO planned to use its own nuclear arms to offset Soviet numerical superiority, even as a first-use option. Contrast with NATO-adjacent military fiction of the era, notably General Sir John Hackett's 1978 The Third World War, which posited a deliberately limited tit-for-tat strategic nuclear exchange that merely wiped out Minsk and Birmingham. But the doctrine and the practice never matched up, for which we may be thankful. Setting aside wartime planning on both sides of the Cold War, the tenets of escalation dominance, or mutually assured destruction, as you prefer, held. They no longer hold. And here is the very dangerous thing the Biden administration has done. You can read about it in the 25th September 2022 Financial Times, but this is the key passage. Western officials said that a nuclear strike against Ukraine would be unlikely to spark a retaliation in kind, but would instead trigger conventional military responses from Western states to punish Russia. It is a passage so astonishing that I reread it multiple times and within the next 24 hours made several phone calls to confirm. Here is what was in aggregate communicated to me. The passage is broadly accurate. As explained, the Biden administration really has told the Russians that, for the first time ever, Russian nuclear weapons use in Europe will not guarantee an American nuclear response. Instead of a nuclear attack in return, the administration has persuaded itself that conventional military responses will be sufficiently deterring. Supposedly, and you ought to consider this very much unconfirmed and uncorroborated, those responses will include NATO attacks on Russian launch sites, plus a NATO-enforced no-fly zone over Ukraine. The latter is functionally indistinguishable from direct NATO entry into the war on the Ukrainian side, and there should be no illusion about it. Again, you ought to regard the preceding two sentences with rational skepticism. I cannot confirm any of it. Nevertheless, there is enough here to profoundly alarm. This much is public and reported. The Biden administration has abandoned the tried and true mechanism of nuclear deterrence and the tenets of well-established escalation dominance theory in favor of a novel and untried theory of conventional deterrence of nuclear escalation. This novel theory rests upon the premise that the Russians dread most a loss of the war in Ukraine, which presumably NATO air power plus Ukrainian armies will guarantee. In short, use a nuke, lose the war. This may or may not be true of the Russian state. It is not true of the Russian regime. The regime's imperative, remember, is to survive. The state is already visibly losing the war in Ukraine. It is obvious within Russia itself, as the quarter million or so who have fled the country since mobilization will attest. And it is plausible that the regime, being directly responsible, will pay the bill. In that light, what is the rational course for that regime now? Well, consider the regime's own narratives. Not just that Ukraine is properly Russian, but that the assembled West is Russia's enemy. The latter is reasonably powerful and reasonably unifying. There are plenty of Russians who believe it, and they are not all themselves irrational on this count. Now, no doubt to the immense surprise of the dictator himself, a message arrives from the Americans. You may use nuclear weapons, and we will not respond in kind. It's astonishing, fantastic, and unbelievable. A gift in full. But, continue the Americans, we will enter the war and help drive you from Ukraine. We will even show how serious we are by leaking this message to the Financial Times. This, all at once, presents Vladimir Putin with something he has not had since the war began on the 24th of February. Abruptly, amazingly, he has an off-ramp from the colossal strategic error that is the Ukrainian war. All he has to do is detonate a nuke. The weapon is used, no doubt on the pretext that the recent sham referenda have made the Donbass Russian territory now under foreign attack. NATO enters the war, and Russia more or less leaves Ukraine after a sufficient bloodletting. Here is the dictator's narrative then. We made good on our threats, on our strength to use our atomic weapons. The West was too frightened of our resolve to reply in kind. Behold, we held them off. They dare not pursue us. It is not an implausible basis for regime survival, an undeserved rescue to be sure, but a rescue nonetheless. I'm Ben Domenech. You're listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. We will be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.